I was actually in a wine group chat that I'm a part of. We were talking about vintages and like birth year wines and all of that. And then we were talking about like buying wines for, you know, siblings or friends, kids, birth vintages, the newer vintages, the like the 2015s and the 18s and the 21s. And I mused in all caps, "There are no bad vintages anymore. Thanks, climate change."
Because everything is warm and humid now?
Because everything's warm and it's kind of like you're never struggling to get the grapes ripe. They're bad vintages basically don't exist anymore. Well,
but then all the wildfires, Jamie, those are not good.
Right, and smoke taint, and that's troubling and definitely affects the vintage, but I would argue doesn't make it bad.
You heard it here first, everybody. Jamie is arguing in favor of climate change. Warm that climate. Yep. Burn those motherfucking polar ice caps. Jamie loves it.
Turn up the heat, y'all. At least we'll have good wine while we're dying. Yep, it's bad. Everything's bad.
It's not great. It's
We have to laugh so we don't cry.
But what if we did both at the same time?
Well, then we would look insane.
We would sound insane, Jamie. This is not a video medium, all right? This is a podcast. We both have turned off our cameras on the Zoom.
You sure that our listeners out there can't see my face? I'm smiling.
They don't know that. All right. Well, I was saying something thoughtful, and then we started talking about how the world is ending, because that's what we do.
Welcome, everyone.
Welcome
to You're Gonna Need a Bigger Bottle. It's a podcast about movies and wine.
It is a podcast about movies and wine. This is the first time ever in all of our Zoom recordings where we haven't fucked up the timing on the welcome and the intros. And I think that's mostly credited to you because you took the beat there. So thank you.
I did. You have to take a little bit of an extra beat because of the Zoom delay.
Right. You have to be prepared. I'm really Scott. Do. Oh, hang on. We'll see now. And now I did, it's ruined. It's over. It's over now. Well, but you said movies and wine. I don't have anything to say. There's nothing for me to interject here.
Yes, it's a podcast about movies and wine. And for those of you in the audience who don't know shit about one or both of those topics, I'm Jamie. I'm the wine guy.
He's Jamie. He's the wine guy. I'm Scott. I'm the movie guy. And we, James and I, are here to help you and, I guess, kind of each other. Normally, each episode, we'll pair a movie that I love with a wine that he loves.
And normally, we tell you why we like them, how they're made, and why they work. Hopefully, we find a pairing that works. Sometimes, we don't. But today, we do something different. Today is the last in our bizarre miniseries.
It hasn't been that bizarre.
It's a little strange. It's a little high concept.
It's self-indulgent. You need to stop calling it high concept. It's not a high wire act. We're not taking any risks. It's just self-indulgence, Jamie, all right? It's mutual self-indulgence.
It's a big old circle jerk.
It's just a straight line. There's only two of us here. Tell the people what we've been talking about for the last five, now six episodes.
We've been talking about Pinot Grigio and The Matrix Resurrections. One grape, one movie, six episodes. We've called this Pinot Grigio versus the M4 Tricks, or... "You ruined every suck my silky Pinot Grigio thing. We had grace, conversations, not all this beep, 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 art, films, books, they were all better. Originality mattered, you gave us face, Zucker, suck and cock me, climatey, wiki, piss and Pinot Grigio."
That, Jamie, was a big swing. You took a real big swing at that accent and at that demented monologue, and I applaud you.
It was fun. I had fun doing that.
But yeah, so this is the sixth and final episode of Pinot Grigio and Matrix Resurrections. We're landing the plane. Jamie, on the wine side, what's the bottle for today? Is this a Pinot Gris or Grigio?
I mean, as we have established through these six episodes, Pinot Gris and Grigio are the same grape.
Then why do they have those different names, Jamie?
One is Italian and the other is French.
Okay, so if I referred to this as a Pinot Grigio, would that be okay by you?
I mean, it's labeled Pinot Gris. You want to respect the
winemaker. Don't be a semantic pain in the ass, Jamie. Respect the winemaker. Tell everybody what it is, you Son of a bitch.
The whole podcast is about both of us being semantic pains in the ass, Scott.
But you love respecting the winemaker. Let's move along.
I do. Today, we're focusing on the 2020 Fossil & Fawn Pinot Gris Rouge.
Rouge.
That's right. It is a Pinot Gris made into a red wine.
And this is mega natty, y'all. It's not Chunkus, but Jamie, I think I'm even detecting Brettanomyces on this wine. Am I detecting that?
I believe there to be a touch.
I'm detecting some BM in this glass, Jamie. Is that not what you guys shorten that down to? You don't say BM.
No, we don't. But now in my head, canonically, Brettanomyces is BM.
And what notes are you detecting on this wine that you're blind tasting? I'm like, well, I'm getting a scotch of BM.
Oh, man, that's too fucking good.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's maybe a little bit of BM on this wine, but you'll note in our little outline, I did not put any Brettanomyces indicators, none of that barnyard kind of stuff, because I think it's maybe just a little accent,
an accent of BM.
That's right,
just a pinch of number two.
So what are we talking about on the movie side, Scotty?
Well, to wrap things up, we've talked about the auteur theory as it applies to the Wachowskis. We've talked about the 12-minute modal prologue that sets the stage for everything. We've talked about the movie in terms of lega sequels. We've focused on a few key characters and some philosophical and critical readings of the movie. And today we're just digging into aesthetic. We're talking about the way that it looks and sounds and feels and why this movie is such a departure aesthetically from the previous Matrix movies and why I at least find that very compelling.
And probably a little on why some people don't find it that compelling.
Well, I don't want to speak to other people's like tastes or experiences or why they feel a certain way, but I'll, you know, attempt to synthesize what I have read of the other takes.
That I think is a fair-minded way to go.
All right, well let's start, Jamie. Let's start with this wine. It's weird.
Yes. Let's start with, I mean, you're tasting it live right now. You didn't prepare your notes in your little Wine Folly journal.
I'm sorry, Jamie. I was too busy socializing with you. You're always telling me how much you enjoy socializing, and I tried that, and I mostly enjoyed myself, and that just meant that I didn't have time to drink this wine ahead, and I'm very sorry.
It was a good time. We had a good time. We saw a movie.
I didn't want to open it 2 days early. I wanted to open it no more than the night before, and then the night before I spent with you and drank, I guess, other wines instead.
Let's talk about this wine. What's it, other than BM, what's it given you?
So the color is wild.
It's a little hazy. It's obviously unfined and unfiltered.
Yeah.
This is not a clear wine.
No, not clear. Hazy is a good word for it. You can't quite see the particulates. It's not chunkusy the way that, like with, what was it, the Chilean sparkling that we did for our last year's Oscar episode?
Cachique Maravilla.
Yeah, it's not chunkus, and I'm not really like detecting any particulates texturally, but definitely not clear. It's got this like beautiful, like a ruby red, almost like a cranberry looking color to it. It's quite lovely. It's very striking, at least on the eyes. The BM on the nose and on the palate, a lot of fruit, very tart, again with like cranberry. And super astringent, right? Like mega astringency, like tongue scrapingly astringent.
I think it is astringent. And I think that that's a large part of the experience of the wine. But I also don't think the astringency is like hyper powerful.
No, I'm getting a lot of that on the tongue, on the roof of the mouth, like really not scraped, like raw the way that some of the like darker super tannic reds that we've had are, but definitely right. like a fine grain sandpaper, you know?
That's kind of what I mean. Like there's a lot of it, but it's not as loud, you know? Yeah. In wine speak, we would say like, this is probably a medium tannin wine, but the texture of it is more important and more in the foreground. Whereas like a Cabernet Sauvignon is a high tannin wine and that just like dries your whole mouth out.
Yeah. Is it sweet? It's not dry, right? It's quite sweet.
No, it's dry.
Is it really? But then there's all these sweet notes that I'm getting.
Yeah, there are sweet notes. You know,
but it's still dry even when it's sweet? Yeah.
It's not, you have to separate, and I've said this before, but you know, we're still here. You have to separate the presence of sugar from a thing that tastes like a sweet thing.
All right, Jamie, I have already met you more than halfway by separating dryness from wetness. All right, dryness is no longer on a continuum with wet for me. I have made that like verbal leap in coming to your side of things. And now the thing that you told me to replace dry with or wet with, sweet, you're saying that, well, we have to separate sweet from sweet? I don't understand. I'm not doing a bit here. I don't understand.
Okay.
So I can detect sugar, but the wine is still not sweet.
No, you're not detecting sugar. You're detecting the flavors of things that are otherwise sweet.
But I'm not detecting the sugar in them.
Right, because there is very, very little sugar left in this wine.
Okay. You understand how convoluted this sounds, right?
It's difficult. I fully understand it. Right. And it is difficult to get there.
I'm not being difficult on purpose. I know that I'm being difficult and it's also fun, but like, I'm not doing this on purpose. It is genuinely unintuitive to me.
It's unintuitive, period. Like to smell and taste a thing that, like, one of my notes here is Welch's strawberry fruit snacks. Cause that's like a kind of a touchstone flavor for me. Cause it's a thing that I ate a lot as a kid. But like I get that big time in this wine and those are sweet things, right? The smells and tastes of that flavor, but without the sugar.
Am I also getting I think it's rhubarb?
Rhubarb.
You said Welch's strawberry fruit snacks. Like maybe it's like a strawberry rhubarb, like a pie or like a jam thing that I'm getting, but something in the ballpark of rhubarb, I think.
Yeah, like a rhubarb. I mean, poached rhubarb is a thing that has been on like some dessert menus that I've worked with that I think is present in this wine. Like a strawberry rhubarb compote.
I love a good compote.
I do too. I also get like this cran apple ocean spray juice cocktail thing going on in this wine that makes me smile a lot because also I love Ocean Spray Cran Apple. It's delicious.
I don't think I have anything else. I think that's the end of my notes.
That's the end of your notes. So
don't sound disappointed. On the spot, those were some good ass notes, Jamie.
They were. They were good ass notes, Scott. This
is extremely condescending about your BM wine, my friend.
My next question for you, though, is do you like it?
Yeah, I think so. It's funky and a little off-putting.
It's pleasant, right?
I don't know that I would go as far as pleasant, but compelling. I'm pouring another glass more quickly than I probably should be.
Don't worry. It's a low-ish alcohol wine. It's only like 12%.
But 13 is high.
13 is like medium.
Okay, whatever. You guys need another percentage scale.
Really, I'm just creating a reason. I'm just enabling you to pour more wine into your glass.
Thank you.
Which is what I do professionally.
Right. Yeah, you're a pusher. You're a professional
pusher. Creating justifications for you to drink more wine.
You are a self-employed professional pusher.
That is correct, yes.
Well, what else are you getting? What are you getting that I'm not getting? You crack out the weird shit, Jamie.
So I think that there's a big herbal note. Like there's like an Herbe de Provence, tarragon, rosemary kind of thing going on in this wine. That I find super fun. I think that ties in with some of the textural element on the palate. It feels like almost that dried herb kind of thing. It's got more of an apple component than I ever expect from a red wine. And I think that's probably because, you know, Pinot Gris lives in an area where it's not exactly a red grape and it's not exactly a white grape. So you get a little bit more malic acid, which is the dominant acid in apples and makes things taste like apples. So like that cran apple thing, it tastes a little bit like dried apple slices. I think other than that, it's pretty straightforward. It's fruit driven. The sort of like gritty, sandpapery tannins do a lot to create interest and intrigue on the palate. And I find this wine to be just a lot of fun to sit and smell and sip.
And this is your type of red, right? You like a red that is light bodied.
Yeah, my taste tends toward like richer white wines and lighter reds, which seems a little bit unintuitive, but sort of in that area is what I like to drink the most. And this is a wine that like, if I had more of it, I would drink more of it, but regrettably, they don't make a ton of it.
Where does this fall on the Jamie spectrum of post-craft wine service? Is this a party wine? Is this what you start people off when they walk in the door? Or is this more complexing, and does it go with like an entree?
It lives in that area where it can be both, which is another thing that I personally respond to. I like wines that are versatile, that I can just have around and not need to have a specific purpose for them. So I could open this up at the door for somebody, or we could sit down and have dinner with it.
What's on the menu? What does this pair with?
This is a wine that it's not extreme in any way. So it can go with a wide variety of foods. I'd like this with seafood. It's almost an obnoxiously easy thing to say just due to the locality. Like, this is from Oregon and there are salmon runs there. And so grilled or baked salmon with this wine sounds amazing to me. But really any of the meatier fishes, you know, like a black bass or like a tilefish, I think would go really well. Anything that you're going to prepare sort of with a French sauce that has a bunch of herbs in it, I think would be great. I say it a bunch, but this wine would go great with pizza also. I think this wine would be a really good pair for some traditional Mexican tacos. This and Tacos al Pastor would be fucking dope also.
What is Tacos al Pastor? Is that like a cheese thing?
No, al pastor is the pork is roasted with pineapple, and that's like a slow cook braise, and then that's put into your corn tortilla.
That sounds outstanding. I want that now. I'm looking it up on New York Times Cooking. I'm saving a recipe. I'm gonna check it out next time.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, so we've talked about flavor. We've talked about nasal profile. We've talked about texture and apparently things that are sweet not being sweet. Give me the conceptual stuff, Jamie. Why do you like this one? Why did this have to be the next part, the final part of your 6-part treatise on Pinot Grigio?
I'm so excited for the next 6-part treatise on Pinot Grigio that I do.
I think I'm going to be sitting that one out.
You're definitely not.
I think I definitely am. I mean, you were like three for six for this miniseries. It wasn't your best hit ratio with me.
That's true. I also think that you are getting more astute in getting these flavor notes, and so you're finding things that you don't like easier. That's the thing that I haven't said, but like, your palate's getting better and more refined, and so like, you're able to identify notes that you don't like a little bit better than before.
This sounds like a compliment with the it trails off with it an ellipsis, and then there's a but. And then I'm just waiting for the butt backhand to come along here.
There's nothing else. I'm so just saying. So
it's not, you're getting more astute at describing the notes that you don't like, but you're getting distracted by those notes and you're missing the bigger picture because you're a fucking simp basic?
No. You are sure? Able to more accurately identify the things that you don't like.
And therefore you are not able to, you know, more successfully trick me into liking things that I don't like.
That's correct. It's also just a matter of like paying attention to that sense more. Fossil and Fawn, it's a cool winery. It's basically just two people. They are romantic partners and business partners. This is Jim Fisher and Jenny Mosbacher. Jim Fisher's position in the company is the vice president of wine things, and Jenny is the deputy chief of stuff. And that very much encapsulates their sort of silly take on life and on winemaking and on their business.
I would like a business card with a title that's stupid on it.
One of my friends started his own consulting company, and his actual title within his company is the Chief Vinovation Officer.
All right. I don't want a business card with a title that stupid on it. I like the whimsical, we don't take ourselves seriously goofiness that Jim and Jenny are doing. I don't like Vinovation. That just sounds like wine synergy.
Yeah, it's a little much.
Vinergy. See, and that's the problem, is that I would be too good at it. I'm too good at coming up with bad offensive portmanteaus. I can't go that far.
We've reached Scott's limit.
Finally, I found one.
So Jim and Jenny lived and met in Oregon. They started this winery based around Jim's family vineyard, which was a small vineyard, is a small vineyard called the Silvershot Vineyard that his father, Jim Sr., had planted in 1999. Jim is about our age, so he was a teenager when all of this happened, and he sort of helped out in the planting of this vineyard. They made a little wine for home consumption, and they sold most of the grapes to other producers. A notable producer that has made wine from this vineyard is Brienne Day, who's really an important figure in Oregon wine. And specifically in the area of Oregon wine that we're talking about, which is the group of people who are trying to do things a little bit differently. Early days of this winery, the wines were actually made at Brienne's facility. Brienne has a reputation for giving young winemakers a little space, a few tanks in her winery, and allowing them to grow with her. And I think that that is fabulous. So a few vintages in, they realized that they needed to expand, bring in a little bit more fruit, both for the health of their business and also for creative reasons. You know, they wanted to do different things, experiment, make things from outside just the Silvershot Vineyard. So they get fruit from a wide variety of places within the Willamette Valley. They also source some fruit from southern Oregon. They've gotten some Chardonnay from Umpqua Valley. They're exploring the different areas of Oregon.
How many different regions are there in Oregon? The only one I'm familiar with is the Willamette Valley. Are there other major regions in the state?
Willamette is obviously the most important. It's the one that most people know about, and it is about an hour and a half outside of Portland, so northwest Oregon. There is also an area that straddles the Washington-Oregon border that's called the Columbia Gorge. The Columbia Gorge is probably the most exciting place for me. There are a lot of really interesting things happening up there. There's a lot of experimentation with different varieties. They've got like Tempranillo planted up there. They've got Gewürztraminer. They've got Mencia. They've got like a ton of different varieties and some really exciting producers. There's a small appellation called the Rocks at Milton Freewater, which is in Oregon, but most of the wineries that produce wine from that region are in Washington for reasons. Then you go to southern Oregon, where you have Umpqua, Rogue, and Applegate valleys. And there are a small handful of other appellations as well, but those are the big ones.
Jamie, I'm going to challenge you at some point in the future, the indeterminate future, to do a whole mini series where you stay away from all of the quote unquote most important regions of a specific country or place.
That's definitely been an idea.
Just the ones that are exciting and not the ones that are the most important or the most dominant or the most influential.
For sure that'll happen. It's sometimes hard to source those wines because they make so few of them, and these wineries tend to be pretty small, but that's definitely been a thought. And I would in particular love to explore lesser known areas of Oregon. Because every time I taste something from outside Willamette, it's exciting. There's a lot of energy going on in that state. Also with inside Willamette, but you know, Umpqua Valley wines I think are really cool. Columbia Gorge, like I said, is I would do a whole mini series on Columbia Gorge. Getting back to this wine, one of the maxims of the winery that Jenny and Jim have is get weird, suck less. I think that that's a noble pursuit, or rather that both of those things are noble pursuits.
So getting weird, I understand. Do they come from Austin? Austin's all about how weird it is, and keep Austin weird, and get weird, Austin.
Portland also is keep Portland
oh,
weird.
Oh, yeah, Portland also has that slogan. I wonder who originated the slogan and which, you know, super lefty city appropriated it from the other town.
I think that I've only heard of it properly from Portland.
Have you been to
Austin?
Austin
is get weird?
Oh, yeah. It's keep Austin weird. So Austin has been weird. They don't need to get weird. They already are weird. And now they're trying to make sure that the straights don't come in and make it less weird.
Right.
That was a slogan I saw everywhere when I spent like 3 days in Austin fucking 10 years ago.
They like getting weird. You know, it's trying different things, experimenting.
Right. But then also sucking less. Did they start out sucking?
Well, I mean, you're talking about two people who didn't have a winemaking background when they got into this. I mentioned to you off mic that I cannot for the life of me remember what Jim's profession was prior to getting into winemaking, but his entree into it was as a teenager helping his dad plant the vineyard, and then he left for a while and came back, and Jenny got a degree in art and then ended up working in tasting rooms in Willamette Valley, and then the two of them met and they decided they wanted to make wine. So, you know, it was an amateur endeavor, and the two of them have made really good friends who have a good understanding of making wine and wine chemistry and all of that. And so their whole maxim is just about doing the best they can each vintage and taking those lessons forward and sucking less.
How much history do you have drinking their stuff? Like how much have they evolved over the years? Do you know?
So I have been tasting their wines since, I want to say it was 2016. It might have been 2017. And I'll say, they have, over the course of that period of time, sucked less. I've always found their wines to be compelling. I've always found them to be interesting. I haven't had a wine from them where I've been like, this is fucked up, and didn't want it for a program that I was running or for my own cellar. But for sure, the 2020 Pinot Gris Rouge, for me, is better than the 2019 was. You can see them evolve, and I think that that's really exciting when you can follow along and watch as winemakers sort of refine their process and make better and better wine.
This is your winemaker auteur theory, Jamie. You're track. No, seriously, like you're tracking their progression. You're watching their style changed while their ethos stays the same. Like this, that's exactly what it is. And you're comparing one bottle to the bottles that came before and talking about it in the context of the others. You can't look at it separate from the context. This is wine auteur theory, baby. It's a real conceptual pairing that we have made, and it only took 6 fucking episodes of this mini series. But there's a callback. We've made several callbacks so far. I should give us more credit than that.
Yes. Yes, we have. And I think you're right. You know, this isn't a thing that happens with every winery. Some wineries have a way that they do things. The evolution is less about the winemaking and more about maybe the farming or more about how the climate is changing. You know, this is each time making something better and trying to find a way of doing things for each wine that makes it better, that makes it closer to a product that they and their consumers want to drink. Not that any of them aren't delicious, but they can always be more delicious. And also not shying away from challenges, not shying away from like some weird variety that isn't usually planted in Willamette, you know, becoming available and, you know, saying like, yeah, we'll take the fruit and we'll see what we can do with it. Taking it year after year and figuring out how to make that wine better. You know, they make co-fermented field blends of Pinot Noir and Pinot Gris
Pinot Noir.
To make sort of a medium style of red wine in between this Pinot Gris Rouge and their just straight Pinot Noir. They do like a skin contact Gewurztraminer, and it's all about figuring out what each wine needs as far as winemaking is concerned. So I'm excited when wineries are open to that kind of thing, or even open to making a wine that is only available for one vintage because the fruit was only available for that vintage.
I like what you're saying about trying to figure out what to do in the process to help this particular wine or this particular bottling. That's something I always like when you talk about like the collaborative nature of filmmaking is when everybody's coming to the same page and they're like, all right, what can I do to help tell the story? Everybody's job is to help tell the story from obviously the director and the writer and the cinematographers, but also the actors and the composers and the costuming people are helping tell the story. And they're all coming together. Even people like sound recordists, a job that according to the Academy isn't actually that important now. And that's why they don't need to have their own special like award consideration. And they don't need to be part of the broadcast, but like even somebody at that level, like, where is the mic going to be placed? What kind of mic do I want to use? What kind of intimacy do I want to create in the vocal capture there? It's just nice to hear that, you know, it sounds like there's a selflessness to it. They're not about putting their stamp on it. They're saying, well, what does this fruit need to be the best wine it can be? I like that.
I also like that. And I like the unselfconscious just going forward with doing something because it's exciting and not having it need to be perfect the first time around, because there's always next vintage. And another thing that I really like about these guys, which I alluded to earlier when I talked about Brienne Day, is a rejection of convention. We're in the Willamette Valley, which is planted to 70% or more just Pinot Noir. You know, when you hear the words Willamette Valley, you think Pinot Noir, or at least I do. And I know that many, many consumers out there do. And I think that it's really, once again, exciting to see a group of winemakers who, while they do make some great Pinot Noir, are really interested in exploring other varieties and seeing what else works in this area. Because when Willamette Valley was started as a conventional wine region, or rather as a commercial wine region, the hat was immediately hung on Pinot Noir, and there wasn't a lot of room for experimentation, and now there kind of is. It's fun to see people make Syrah, and it's fun to see people make Gewürztraminer or Riesling or Tempranillo or whatever the case may be.
Or Pinot Gris.
Or Pinot Gris. I mean, Pinot Gris was the sort of sister variety to Pinot Noir in the come up. It represents most of the rest of that 30%. The small amount of other varieties that I'm talking about are, you know, in the single digit percentile. There is not a lot of them planted, but it's really cool to see what they can be. You know, I've had Willamette Valley Gruner Veltliner, which is a whole other experience from the Gruner that we had, that now I'm forgetting what movie we paired it with. Was that Shaun of the Dead? The Loimer?
Shaun was the Loimer. Yep. Yeah.
Loiner Gruner Veltliner. You know, there's a winery called Illihi that makes a Gruner that's absolutely beautiful. And they also make a Viognier. And these are all wineries and winemakers that talk a lot to one another and, you know, talk about the vineyards that they're sourcing from and their farming techniques and what they're doing in the winery. And there's like a free flow of information. And I also love that. That's a thing that I think is really lacking from the wine regions that we're close to here on the East Coast. It's a thing that I'd like to see more, that like communication and collaboration.
You mentioned is it the Eyrie or the Eyrie?
The Eyrie.
We had the Eyrie Pinot Noir the other night, actually.
Did you really?
Yeah, Tani went out and picked up a bottle. She's doing what I'm doing now, which is just like, oh, here's winemakers and names that we've heard, and that's a good enough reason to pick up their bottles at the store. And it's just all like podcast adjacent stuff that we've been getting lately.
I love that.
Well, shut up. It's not about you, Jamie. All right. This is about us finding the shortest distance between entering the store and leaving the store. This is not about validating your choices.
Well, did you like it?
I mean, it was pretty fucking great. Yeah. It was not your typical Pinot Noir, which is, you know, dark and brooding and inky and high tannic and high body. This was a real departure from that.
God damn it. Now you're doing a bit. Before
now I'm doing it on purpose.
Before you
the
were.
First two times I had a misconception, and then I forgot that you corrected me, and so you loved correcting me again. No, this time I'm just fucking with you.
Dick.
Paint me a picture. Why is this the end point of the miniseries, and where is this on our flavorful journey through the PG?
Okay, so this wine for me represents the experimentation and innovation that has yet to be explored with Pinot Grigio or Pinot Gris, whatever you want to say. And I think that that's important to think of even more broadly with other varieties, just to understand that there isn't one answer to what can Pinot Noir be. There isn't one answer to, you know, what can or should Cabernet Sauvignon be, in the same way that there isn't one answer for Pinot Gris or Grigio or for the Willamette Valley or for the Maipu Valley or for Mendoza or for Burgundy, even, despite the French need to put every damn thing into law. I think that Fossil and Fawn, along with their contemporaries, are unconcerned with consumer trends and are just trying to make wines that express themselves and their land. And I think that's really exciting. It's less about trying to satisfy a wide swath of people because, well, they have the privilege to do that because the wineries are small and they don't have to sell a million cases of wine. They only have to sell maybe a couple thousand at most. This wine for me is an assertion that tradition can't be the only marker for typicity and
Hang on, I'm sorry. So one of these words is going to have to be bleeped.
Yep.
And that's the second one. Typicity? I thought this was a typo on the outline. Typicity?
Typicity.
No way. Absolutely not a word.
Look it up. You've got a computer in
Son
front of you.
Bitch.
Fucking look it up.
According to the Wikipedia, typicity, French and Italian roots, is a term in wine tasting used to describe the degree to which a wine reflects its varietal origins and thus demonstrates the signature characteristics of the grape from which it was produced. E.g., how much a Merlot wine tastes like a Merlot. It is an important component in judging wine competition when wines of the same variety are judged against each other. Okay. That's yep. dumb. That doesn't feel like a word, but I will stand down and concede to you that in your circles that you travel in, typicity is somehow a word.
It's a word.
All right.
And for me, for both typicity and terroir, the people in that area, the people more broadly who are drinking these wines, we get to decide what those things are, or even if they're important at a given time or place. And that's why I chose this wine to finish the series with, because for me it represents the future.
This does not feel like it's representing the typicity of Pinot Grigio.
No.
This is wild left field kind of shit compared to the five that we've had so far.
Exactly. This is the one that sticks out like a sore thumb. We even had an orange wine in there with the Scarbolo Ramato, and this is the one that really sticks out as something completely different. And for me, that's exciting. You know, it's not just exciting that this wine exists. It's also really great that there is a defined style in other places that works. I would just like to, you know, see more and more people experiment and see what they can do and see what boundaries can be pushed. You know, I don't think it's any shock to you or anyone out there who knows me, or probably if you've been listening long enough, you get that I respond to this kind of attitude. We don't have to define things so strictly, that it's important to see what new can be done.
Almost sounds like you're talking about a little motion picture called Lana Wachowski's 2021 fucking postmodern pop culture deconstruction, The Matrix Resurrections.
Well, I wasn't, Scott. I was talking about Pinot Grigio, but you can take it however you want to take it.
I did, and I took it to, I want to think about something else.
Yeah.
No, but I quite like this one. You have taken me on a journey through Pinot Grigio. I had very little preconceptions of Pinot Grigio prior to this miniseries, other than it's Pinot Grigio, sir, the great Lego Alfred, saying to Lego Batman. But yeah, this one is wildly unexpected, and it's been quite a ride. And I'm going to try to remember these things going forward. Because I had no idea about Pinot Grigio or Pinot Gris, which apparently don't mean anything different, and the words are interchangeable, according to Jamie.
I mean, they are. But they do.
Except that they're not. They're not. If they were, then they would have a fucking either-or option on the label here.
Anyway, is it... We're done talking about this wine, right? And we're done talking about Pinot Grigio, at least for now.
I feel like for now we've said an awful lot about Pinot Grigio.
We sure have.
Has any podcast ever dedicated more hours to talking about Pinot Grigio?
You know, we may be the foremost podcasters about Pinot Grigio in the world.
Wow. Huh. That might be something of value to someone. To us, probably.
I mean, if it's of value to anyone, it's of value to us, but I don't think it's actually of value to us.
We are, minute for minute, the foremost podcasting experts on Pinot Grigio.
That is correct, yes.
Wow. Take that, Disgorgeous. You talk about Pinot Grigio for 6 fucking hours and find new things to say.
Are we ready, Scott, to start talking about the anti-aesthetic?
I think we should.
Or do we have to talk about the aesthetic first?
Well, we definitely have to talk about the aesthetic first. For sure. Before we can talk about how it's an anti-aesthetic, we have to talk about what the aesthetic is.
Okay.
This is the shit I've been waiting for, the whole miniseries. Like, I like talking about the body of work and the filmography, and I like talking about themes and going super granular on, like, individual sequences and characters. But, like, man, talking about aesthetic, this is what gets me up in the morning.
I mean, I would do another episode on The Analyst, though.
A whole nother episode? I feel like we've said enough about The Analyst.
But I like The Analyst a lot.
So do I, but I do feel like we've said enough about it.
That maybe. I could pair another wine with The Analyst.
Well, do that on your other podcast, Jamie, which I'm not producing.
I am absolutely not doing another podcast. No. This one is exhausting enough.
You're telling me. All right, so the aesthetic. Before I dive deep on it, I would like to hear from your purview, because the thing I'm most interested in is how the aesthetic of this movie is different from the aesthetic of the original movies and why. Can you just give me your impressions, first of the old movies? Why don't we just focus on the 1999 movie, which is the one that this movie is really most referencing and in conversation with. So what is the look of that 1999 movie?
It's green.
Yes, lots of green. Less green than maybe we think, though.
Yeah, it lives in my memory as green, and then on my latest rewatch, and I know that there was, like, they did something to the color thing on release, right?
Well, so like there's been this increasing trend, and I have been guilty of it, of, like, complaining about the new 4K masters that have been coming out of a lot of new movies, or a lot of older films, rather, and that they don't look like what we remember them looking like, and that it feels like The Matrix was a big one, where all the scenes in The Matrix, everybody remembers being extremely green and almost like monochrome, in that green is the only dominant color. There's been this pushback, and that it's possible that it's just that the original DVD was so pushed to green for that transfer, because, like, the less color variety is, the more resolution and detail you can get out of your bitrate, essentially. That maybe for the DVD release, they pushed it really hard into the green. And then that was, you know, the DVD that fucking everybody owned, essentially. And then that kind of replaced our memory of what it looked like. Like, it's possible that this new 4K master that tries to bring more blues and more, like, warmer tones into the saturation or into the color palette is actually closer to what the original theatrical 35 looks like. But I haven't heard anything concrete on that.
Okay.
But okay. Definitely, well, green. Definitely there is a lot of green in those scenes.
Super green. Inside the Matrix. Outside the Matrix, it's monochrome, but it's there's green, but it's much more gray.
It's like gray blue. Yeah, it's very cool.
In having those color choices, like they're not maybe as rigid as they live in our memories because of the DVD or whatever. But just in making that choice, the whole thing becomes its own unique. What am I trying to say here?
I don't know.
I'm trying to say that it is hyper distinct from other films prior to.
Right. It has a very distinct and specific aesthetic.
Right.
Like something that is identifiable as The Matrix. And if you try to do something that looks like that, it will just end up looking like The Matrix and not like another very green movie.
Right. That is what I was trying to say very, very badly.
Well, that's what we're here for. What about texture? Do you have notes on texture of the original movie?
Texture, I don't have, so I'll create some notes now that I'm thinking about it. But the real world feels more gritty, grainy, and the inside the Matrix feels more smoothed out.
Oh, that's interesting. Because I would actually say the opposite. In terms of, my recollection is always that the scenes in the Matrix feel both grainier in terms of, like, visible film grain, but also in terms of contrast, that the blacks are deeper and the fall off into shadows is sharper. And the whites and the bright highlights are oftentimes, like, blown out in the Matrix scenes in the original movie. And then in the real world, it's blue and it's cool. And the contrast feels to me much less extreme than it does in the Matrix scenes.
Yeah, I agree with that. I maybe my sense of things is colored by that sort of the lower contrast that you're talking about outside the Matrix gives it sort of it's more homogenized, the image.
Interesting. Okay. Now, of course, I'm talking about texture of the image, but are you talking about the image or the texture of the world? Because if we're talking about texture of the world, what you were saying, where the Matrix looks cleaner and the real world is grittier, makes perfect sense to me, right? Like everything on the Nebuchadnezzar is grimy and grungy and dirty looking, and everything in the Matrix looks clean. But then I think the actual filmmaking aesthetic is kind of the reverse of that.
I think I have trouble making that distinction, especially when it's doing that like reversal thing that you just described. Yeah.
Okay, and then what about Resurrections? So we talked about color, talked about texture. So Resurrections, what are your thoughts on the color of that movie?
It is not quite so green. When you see pops of green, you see these pops of code. Like I'm thinking of the Tokyo train sequence, and I'm also thinking of the eyes of the drones or whatever when they get activated, the bots.
Right, or Morpheus looking in the mirror and self-actualizing, or when the analyst uses his like rewind bullet time 2.0 power and Trinity just kind of dissolves into code in one of the most amazing effects, I think, in the entire movie. But there's lots of green when you actually see the code.
Correct.
But I don't think there's really any green outside of that in the new Matrix, in the analyst's Matrix within Matrix Resurrections.
Right. It feels more like our real world. It feels maybe more true to life.
Well, what is that line that Groff drops after in his big introduction, and billions of people living out their lives oblivious, and then he looks out on the vista of the whole world and he's like, God, it's just too perfect, isn't it? Like he's confiding in Tom, like, I totally would believe that this is all fake, which of course it all is, but it just looks completely real because it is real.
Yeah, that's what another thing that I had been thinking about, because I knew we were going to have this discussion, is there's something about the movement that goes on inside the Matrix that is faster and more frenetic than the 99 Matrix.
Interesting. Do you mean movement in general or like during the fight and action scenes?
I mean movement in general. I mean both the camera and the characters.
Okay. Interesting. The camera I can speak to. I don't know that I necessarily know what you mean by the characters, other than just that, like, because of the looser camera movement in this movie, it might feel like characters are moving more frenetically because you're not perceiving it in such a like pulled back way as in the original movie.
I think also with the characters, it's the like a function of them not having the "we are super cool, we don't move our torso" kind of thing that the guys in the old Matrix did.
Yeah, the whole, and I mean, that's another thing with aesthetic, right? Like aesthetic is not just, and like we're focusing on color and texture right now, but aesthetic is not just what the camera captures, but it's production design and it's costume design and it's hair and it's makeup and it's whatever affect that a director might direct their cast to put on. And this movie, we talked about it before that, yeah, the people in the Matrix, like Bugs and her crew, they kind of look the same. Like that, it's an evolution of the style, the residual self-images that everybody projected of like being super sweet and rad and covered in leather and all black and everybody wears sunglasses all the time from the old movies. But then their performance, they're not affectless. Like they actually are able to express more joy and surprise, and it's less about like just projecting cool all the time.
You were going to expand on the camera bit.
There's a lot that's different between this movie, 2021's Matrix Resurrections, and 1999's The Matrix, and also the sequels. We talked about color. So you think that the Matrix in the new movie looks more like the real world, and I think it does. And part of that is just that there's a lot of location photography. Like almost everything that takes place in the Matrix was shot on location, which is like a huge deal. The entire original movie was shot on backlots and sound stages. And things that were on rooftops were, you know, like on a soundstage with a lot of green screens or like maybe on the rooftop of like a backlot building. things like in city streets and some of the running, like when Neo is being chased, like a lot of that feels like it's just shot like, you know, on like one of the Paramount or the Warner Brothers backlot where they've got like a couple of city streets and you just come out and decorate it to look like whatever city or not you want it to look like. And then your characters can run through. This one is like the office buildings that's shot on location, the car chases, the motorcycle chases, everything that's in The Matrix is filmed on location. And that's like part of that is this huge evolution in style that Lana and her sister Lily Wachowski have kind of come through over the last 15 years of their career. I read a couple of great interviews with Danielle Masacesi. He is the co-cinematographer of this movie, also working with John Toll, who the Wachowskis have worked with previously. Danielle started with the Wachowskis as a camera operator, doing like maybe a couple of days on Speed Racer, and then was like one of their go-to camera operators on Cloud Atlas, which according to him was probably the first time that Lana and Lily ever actually shot on location, which is crazy to think about. But like for everything that they directed prior, like Bound, the three Matrix movies, and Speed Racer, everything was shot in a studio in a controlled environment. Nothing was shot out in the real world. And the way that Masacesi describes it is that it they were very nervous in the beginning and they didn't seem comfortable with it. And then suddenly they realized all the things that you can be offered by letting go of control, right? Like the great thing about shooting in a studio is you have control of the elements. The sun is not a problem. Clouds are not a problem. Wind is not a problem. Like you have complete control over creating and capturing a world, but then you also lose variety and you lose variables and unpredictability and how you can respond to that. And so the stuff they shot on Cloud Atlas was this major turning point. And then every movie that they've shot since then has had more and more and more location work. We've already talked on the show about the big chase scene in Jupiter Ascending, which was all shot like basically 20 minutes at a time, all during magic hour in Chicago at dawn. This like enormous chase scene that they basically shot for like an hour every day for all 6 months of principal photography. But then after that, they go and they do Sense8. And Sense8 is filmed on location in, I think by the end of the show, it was like 10 or 11 cities that they filmed in. All around the world, everything filmed on location. And all using natural light is the other thing. That's been this big push for shooting on location and using natural light with very little augmentation. And when you do bring in additional lights, when you're shooting on location with real light, she's only doing it to augment or to supplement the actual natural sunlight that's there, or to like amp up a practical light, like a light fixture that's actually in the shot. But like, in this movie, to think about that, to shoot this whole movie and all the Matrix scenes on location in natural light, like they're shooting fight scenes and shootouts and car chases and a motorcycle chase at Tiffany's garage. Like these are all things shot on location, even things that you would think you would build a set for, like the big fight in the warehouse when Smith reenters the movie and then the Merovingian and all of his guys show up. That wasn't a set.
Right. And you see that like incredible vista out the window.
Yeah. And it's, you don't even see a vista. It's just the setting sun, that like gorgeous orange setting sun that's coming down and creating all of that light. And they did it all for real on location, which is crazy. It like really limits the amount of time that you can spend shooting a fight scene that you want to be able to shoot multiple takes over and over and over again. But it's just this like major ethos that Lana has discovered and has like really embraced. And it's changed the way that she does other things in her filming, too.
Other things like what?
Well, so this is the other thing. And we didn't really talk about it too much, you and I. But the other major departure in this movie, other than this change in color, right? Instead of the Matrix being green, it looks more like the real world. It also looks more like a very like Hollywood stock color palette. It's the Michael Bay color palette. It's like it's cyan and orange, that like extreme punchy teal blue and a really, really harsh reddish orange color that look great together. But it's a very stock and repeated and kind of derided image. And I do think it's compelling that she brings that into this movie because it does look like the real world, but it also looks like Hollywood, like more than the Matrix ever really looked like Hollywood.
I had not thought about that or even considered it.
Just think about like how many of the scenes in the movie are filmed at sunset with that like beautiful orangey reddish, you know, setting sun color that it inflects.
Yeah. And I'm thinking about like so many of the interiors that are filmed against giant windows. the analyst's office has this giant window. And then when they're in the analyst's office at the very end and they blow the side off the building.
That, I wonder if that's a green screen. I had heard that all the stuff in The Matrix was shot on location, but I wonder how much of that is like an actual set with like a green screen extension going out of it. I don't know. That's just speculating, but they're, because that whole, the vista of San Francisco that's out that window is this like painterly, almost fantasy vision of San Francisco that doesn't quite gel with the real world, you know?
Right. But also Tiff's workshop, the garage, there's that giant window there too.
Yeah, and a giant window and all that crazy gorgeous orange light coming in, and they shot all of it for real, and that is one of the most elaborate like visual effects and gags in the whole movie. That's when the analyst deploys his rewind, his super slow motion mega bullet time, and they did all that. Like, that shit is not filmed on a green screen. Like, when they did bullet time in 99, it's Keanu in a sound stage and everything is green all around him. And the original bullet time effect was they had like a couple of dozen still cameras, like SLRs, that were all wirelessly coordinated to shoot in, you know, succession, like a single frame going around him. And then they stitched them all together when they get the best take. But like, it had to be a controlled artificial environment. And then he's just composited into a digital recreation of that rooftop. All of the slow-mo bullet time shit in this movie, Jamie, this is crazy to me. So another huge departure visually for this movie is that it's not shot on film. It is shot entirely on digital. I forget which one. It's one of the Red cameras. Alexa and Red are like the two big digital, like standard cinema cameras that everybody uses now. And Red even made like a special custom one just for Lana Wachowski, where they somehow...
Of course they did.
But it's in her, the colors of her dreads. Like she has her hair like in these pink, purple, and orange hues that she always wears them in, and they match. They got like Pantone to use pictures of her or something, and they match the three colors, and then the body of her special custom Red camera is those exact right colors.
That's fucking wild.
Isn't that nice? That's really sweet. But yeah, all the bullet time things is they had two of these like Red cameras with their huge sensors basically mounted side by side in the same way that you would shoot a 3D image, and then by having the two images filmed together but slightly off at an angle, essentially like it gives you the parallax, the same way that your eyes work with binocular vision, except with this instead is that they had one of them filming at standard 24 frames a second at like 8K, and then the other camera was shooting at like 150 frames a second at 12K. So when you have NPH speaking and delivering dialogue while the sparks from like the welding or whatever tools are going off in Tiffany's workshop are like flying behind him in super slow motion, that's not a digital effect. That is just compositing those two shots that are filmed in the same place at the exact same time. And they're just capturing them at different times.
That's so cool.
But all on location, all in the place with the real sunlight.
That sounds extremely challenging, given that the sun moves at a particular rate.
It sounds super challenging. It sounds like the shit that stresses crews out. But Lana's whole thing is that, like, she likes shooting on location. She likes being free and liberated and loose and improvisational and responsive to what's happening, but also not stressing anybody out and just keeping it super chill. And everything I've read about her sets that she's been running is, yeah, it's just chill. We're all here to have a good time. Nobody needs to yell. We're not going to stress about the sun because we'll just get it. It'll be cool. We've got good people and we're going to figure it out.
I like that attitude, but also the person who like plans in me just like freaks out knowing that it's a really hard job and that there is a time limit.
It's a couple dozen really hard jobs, right? Like it's hard for everybody. I'd listened to a podcast interview. I think it was on IndieWire's Filmmaker Toolkit podcast, and they interviewed some of the sound team members for the movie. And they talked about that, like, yeah, it was this major departure from basically any other project they'd done before, and certainly from the old Matrix movies, where, like, for this new one, like, for the big motorcycle chase at the end, and then where, like, the helicopter is there shooting rockets at Trinity and Neo. So they basically just, like, showed up on set for the day. And by set, I mean location, like a real San Francisco street. And they would just show up, and the department heads would walk through the locations with Lana for the car chase on the day. and they would decide the camera placement. They would decide what the shots were going to be. And then they would decide where the explosives would be placed and which cars were going to get blown up.
Wow.
Like they had, you know, a certain number of things. Like they knew, like, we need to convey these couple of beats, and maybe these are going to be like some of the images that we need to capture. But she's not shot listing anymore. She's responsive. It is this major departure. This is the thing that I think people are really responding to, and why a lot of people have one of the early critiques is that the action is not good on this movie, which I think, with one exception, that's not fair. Like, I think the Tokyo bullet train fight, like, looks like ass. I don't think it looks good. I think the conceit is that, like, because we're so subjective with Neo and he's so out of his depth and disoriented because the red pill is working on descrambling his signal or whatever, that, like, it's choppy and disorienting and we can't get into the action because he can't fight and he can't get into it. But it still doesn't make it a pleasant sequence to watch. And I have a feeling that there's, like, some major COVID impact on the filming of that. And maybe that's why it just looks like butts so much.
I wasn't bothered by that scene.
That one really bugs me.
The conceit that Neo isn't in it was kind of enough for me.
It's just kind of, it's very choppy. It's kind of cut to hell. And even when we're, like, focusing on characters other than Neo, like, I just need, like, a beat longer than I'm given to really process what's happening in a lot of those fight shots.
I suppose. It's also a very linear bit of action. Like, literally, they're going through a train. Like, you kind of know that they are moving in one direction. So I don't know. I wasn't bothered by it, but I can see the complaint. And I can see what you're saying also.
That's the only one that really bothers me. I think all the rest of the action is great. But the big difference is, like, the action is so not like what we remember the action in The Matrix being.
Right.
The old movies, especially the first one, but that continued to be their process. For the first one, when they sold the script to Warner Brothers, this was before they had directed Bound, and basically Bound was, like, almost like a proof of concept, where Warner's was like, we like this script, we don't get it, but, like, you have to go and prove to us that, you know, you can make a movie. So they make Bound, and the studio was like, all right, great, you guys know what to do. But to prove to Warner's that they could do it, they brought in some comic artists that they had worked with before, and they just storyboarded the entire movie. And that is largely the movie that they shot. It's rigid, right? Like, the original movie, it's a bunch of very stark, graphic, carefully composed and thoughtful images that are put together, and especially in the fight scenes, right? Like, the way that the fight scenes were filmed in the first movie and in all the sequels, they had Yuen Wu-Ping, one of, like, the great all-time fight choreographers, and the way that his philosophy of choreographing a fight scene is that he is also essentially the second unit director. So he comes up with what the fight is, and then the photography of the fight is dictated by what is the best place to put the camera to convey the movement, the story, and for any particular hit or beat to possibly hide how it's a stunt, right? So, like, you need to put the camera in the right place to hide that they're not actually hitting. You need to put the camera in the right place to emphasize movement, but also to keep geography clear. And between the storyboarding and the way that the fight scenes are choreographed and thought out, like, the part of the visual aesthetic of the original Matrix is, like, careful and composed, and it's like the action scenes are somewhere on a spectrum with, like, Wes Anderson. These perfect, like, little dioramas where, like, your viewpoint is so carefully guided and perfect. And that is not how this movie feels at all.
I've got a question for you.
Yeah.
The style that you're describing of the 99 Matrix and the style that you're describing of Resurrections, do you think that it would have been possible for the Wachowskis to, obviously no studio considerations into this, but, like, could Matrix 99 have been done in the Resurrections way without the, like, high level of experience that they gained along the way?
No. And but it's not that they wouldn't have had the ability. Like, we don't know, right? Like, Bound, their only movie prior to that, like, also looks of a piece with this. It's very carefully composed, and all the images are, like, super thought out. And in a way that we've talked about with people like Edgar Wright before, where, like, it's somebody who has the whole movie in their head.
Right.
The early Wachowski stuff is that way as well. Like, the whole movie is in their head and then transplanted onto paper. So it's not even an ability thing. It's that their aesthetic had not evolved over time. The biggest influence on the aesthetic of Resurrections is Sense8. It's the first project that the Wachowskis ever, and in particular Lana, who was the only one of the two of them to work on season 2, but it was the only Wachowski project that is television. And TV doesn't, you just don't have the time. Like even for Sense8, which is one of the most expensive TV shows ever made, you don't have the time to do take after take after take. Like you're budgeted to get X number of pages or scenes shot in a given day. And so she suddenly became much more improvisational and fluid. And in addition to this love that she had developed for shooting in natural light and shooting on location, she also discovered this fondness for not storyboarding, for just getting to the set, watching the actors block it, and working with her DP and her camera operator to figure out the best places to put the cameras, and shooting with multiple cameras. So again, co-DP on this movie and longtime Wachowski camera operator, Danielle Masacesi. This technique that they developed is that Lana likes to be right with him while he's operating Steadicam, so she can look over his shoulder, see what the monitor on his Steadicam rig is showing, so she can always follow the framing. And she always has a hand on his shoulder or like on his vest, so she can guide him a little bit. Like, I need you to move to the right to change the frame. I need you to move to the left. But then she started to like to shoot with two cameras, because when you're shooting with two cameras, it's just more efficient, right? You can get your coverage for both angles essentially at the same time. And there's things that you sacrifice, but it means that you can move more quickly and you can do also more takes and repeat over and over again. So the way that they did it so that she could check framing on both cameras at the same time is that strapped to his back was an iPad, essentially.
Oh my God.
So she's looking over Masacesi's shoulder to see what his frame is, and she can see like a wireless live image on the iPad strapped to his back of what the other camera operator is doing, so she can call out directions to them.
Okay, so this is kind of what I was getting at when I asked you the question earlier about like, would this have been possible? Like everything that you're describing seems like it requires a higher level of skill than the like very rigid shot listed style. Like in order to be this off the cuff, you have to be of a particular level of filmmaker. Like you have to have done this a lot.
I don't agree.
Okay.
I don't think it's about more skill. I think it's about different skill sets.
Interesting.
Because like there's also some filmmakers who start in this place, who start being loose and improvisational, and we don't storyboard, and I just like to walk the set and then figure out what the shot list is. I'm not saying that this couldn't have happened before because she wasn't good enough. I'm saying this couldn't have happened before because this only happened because of the intervening 20 years of her career. And this change that she's had in style and also in ethos about how she likes to run her set.
Right. I get that. I'm feeling a little bit of overlap or a little bit of crossover between my own career, you know, as a beverage director. You know, early on, it was very much everything had to be rigid and well thought out, and I needed time to make decisions, and I needed everything had to be planned and very specific. And now that I've been doing it for a long time, I prefer to be a little bit extemporaneous, and I can sort of live, like I have an idea of what and where everything is, and I can make decisions on the fly that are beneficial to everyone and that allow it all to sort of stay loose. And I don't think that would have been possible, and also to like achieve at a high level early in my career.
I mean, I guess some of it is experience and influences of other people, and then some of it is also just the confidence that you get from experience, right? You do have to have a certain level of confidence to say, like, I've always done it this way before, where I planned ahead and was very careful and I got it exactly the way that I planned for, to then suddenly say, well, you know what? We know enough of what we're doing that we can kind of riff. Not that we're not going to do the homework, but that we're going to do different homework, essentially.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just, it's interesting because I've been thinking about that a lot. The amount of time it took me to run beverage programs early in my career is so different from what it is now. Even like doing it in 2018 versus doing it now. I think about it a lot, and the way I've changed and the way I sort of move through the world. So what you're saying resonates with me in that way.
I've had sort of like an inverse journey. Like my career is very much on the back burner right now as I focus on podcasting and taking over the podcast charts, and also more importantly, trying to raise a, you know, kind and decent human being in a terrible, brutal world. But in my old gig, when I was running movie theater and festival operations, like I started at that gig wildly underqualified and without enough resources to like really plan ahead. And everything was much more improvisational. And I've always been kind of good on my feet and good in a crisis. And, you know, we didn't have the materials and the planning and the documents that we needed. But like in my brain, I was able to keep a lot of it together. And, you know, it was like a lot of on the fly decision making, essentially. And then over time, like as I was able to rise up and advocate better for what my department needed, like suddenly I was able to find the time to, and I just knew what we needed to plan for. And suddenly I was all about spreadsheets and documents and distributing documents and paperwork to everybody early. And suddenly my job got so much easier on the day. Like I think the last two festivals that I worked, like my hours leading up to the festival were bananas insane. And then once the festival started, it was like, I had a lot of paperwork in the morning and a lot of paperwork in the evening. And for the rest of the day, like I could kind of bounce around and my people knew had what they needed and it was all planned. It was all storyboarded. It was all shot listed. You know, we knew what it was going to be.
That's very interesting. I like that we've had that different take, but it ends in the same way. And like the job is easier and you do better at it.
I mean, it ultimately comes down to experience, you know? And experience and exposure to other things. Like, had Lana not worked with certain crew members or on certain projects, like if Cloud Atlas never happened, maybe she never would have shot anything on location ever, you know? And then Sense8 probably doesn't happen. Or if it does, it's not something that they shoot in 8 cities around the world. And then Resurrections has this radically different look.
Just thinking about that sounds insane. This evolution is so compelling. And I mean, you know how much I loved Sense8. I lapped up every minute of that. And so much of the magic is literally being transported from city to city and place to place.
And to feel the reality of it, even in very unreal narrative circumstances. The crazy, like the fights and the car chases, like in that show and in this movie, The idea that they didn't storyboard the fights is just bananas to me, especially thinking about how carefully crafted and composed. And I don't want to say like that they're stifled or that they're like hermetically sealed, the fights and the action beats in the old Matrix movies, because they're not. But there also is this level of control over them. They are these perfect plastic objects in a way. That the characters exist in, right. And the characters are what give it the life and the organic surprises and the humanity. But like the actual things are like perfectly sculpted out of marble, essentially. And then this movie, it's just not like that. And even if it's not as like, I don't find the fights and the action in this movie to be as aesthetically pleasing, just based on my own like particular style and my own preferences. I don't find them as aesthetically pleasing as in the old movies, but I do find them at least as compelling, if not more compelling than the other ones. And it's just a totally different vibe. They just feel radically different. But the question is, why?
That is the question.
Why have such a radical change, right? So like I've talked about that the part of the why is just the people that she's worked with and the projects that she's worked on and that has influenced the style and the way that she wants to tell these types of stories, that Lana is just a different filmmaker than she was 20 years ago.
Right, but there's a why that deals specifically with this movie and this story.
We've talked about it a bunch. We talked about it in our analyst episode most recently about how the Matrix, the movies, are a product of a system that it's, whether you call it the machine or the man or the Matrix, it is a thing that weaponizes every assault against it and turns it back on you. I think this aesthetic choice is very much part of that conversation that's happening in the movie. I'm referencing a lot here from a piece by filmmaker Adam Egypt Mortimer that he wrote on Inverse.com not long after the movie came out. It's called The Matrix Resurrections is a Full Frontal Attack on the Matrix. We will, of course, share a link to it in the description and on the socials. So I don't fully embrace Adam's conclusions. Like, he thinks that the movie has an intentional ugliness, whereas I just don't think it's ugly really at all. But his big point, and I'm quoting here, is that because Lana, like Neo, is compelled to resist control, to courageously reject her own aesthetic in favor of following the truth, right? Like, why didn't she make the analyst's Matrix look like the old Matrix? Why is it such a radical departure? Why does the analyst Matrix look like Sense8, essentially? Why is it that, like, beautiful, grainless, realer than real, like, hyper high resolution digital photography? Why isn't it grainy and green?
Well, I think the simplest explanation is that the analyst is a different character, and we need a different aesthetic to believe that this is a different Matrix, that this is new code, right? Like that's a way of signaling that this is almost a physically different place than the old Matrix.
I concur. I completely agree that it serves a narrative function, that the aesthetic being so different has narrative value for the audience. It tells us it's something different. And I just find it so compelling that she makes the new Matrix, and not the real world, on the ships and in Io, the city with Jada Pinkett, but just the new Matrix looks like the real world that she so beautifully captured on location all around the globe in Sense8. I find that super compelling. But then there's this other element where it's basically political. Like, this is what Adam Egypt Mortimer is saying, that Lana's and Lily's, their original Matrix movies were like Baudrillard said, like we talked about in our last episode, that they are compromised by the nature of their distribution, right? So you can make a movie as much as you want. You can have a piece of narrative that says that the machine wants to grind you up and repress you and turn your dreams into product, and it just wants to exploit you and use you for money. But then when that narrative is released as a big blockbuster movie, it's lessened, and the machine gets to co-opt the message and lessens and kind of dulls the message, essentially. And the machine then owns your aesthetic. So if she were to go back and do the old look, that's her returning essentially to almost like a prison. It's confined. She's an artist who wants to evolve and do something different, so she doesn't want to do what she did before. And that's something that she said to all of the crew members, between the DPs and the sound people, don't worry about what it looked and sounded like before. We're doing a different thing. And I think part of that is your narrative thing, but it's also her wanting to evolve. And it's also her saying no, we're not going backwards. We're not doing that. That's been co-opted. The old Matrix is the architect's Matrix, and the analyst and the architect and the studio, our parent company, Warner Brothers, these things are all the fucking same. And we're going to do something different, and it's a new thing, which, of course, they're going to immediately co-opt anyway. But we're going to say something different with the way that it looks and that it feels.
That's pretty, it's audacious.
It's a deep movie, man. It's there's a fucking lot going on in the decisions and just how the thing is lensed, let alone everything else.
And also to take the studio, this same studio's money, and turn around and make a movie about how they own the old aesthetic and it's not hers anymore, and it's essentially a middle finger to these people who are funding this new thing.
I feel like the whole thing is a middle finger to Warner Brothers. And the recurring line that I've heard in the press from, I think it was from Lana, but also from David Mitchell, who's one of the co-writers, and a few other people, is that whenever anybody asks them in interviews about the Smith line, our parent company, Warner Brothers, is going to make a sequel, and they're going to do it with or without us, everybody says the same thing, which is, and the folks at Warner Brothers have a good sense of humor. I'm sure they do have a good sense of humor, but also it doesn't lessen the enormity of that middle finger that they're being given.
Right. You don't include that line unless there is a nugget of truth there, right?
It is known. There is truth that Warner Brothers went back to the two Wachowskis over and over and over again over the years. Hey, what do you think? Should we do another one? Should we do another one? We don't want to do it without you. We'll talk again next year. And then they started talking about Michael B. Jordan's production company was interested. And then they talked to, I think, Zach Penn was maybe going to write a draft. And that's when Lana was like, fuck, all right, I guess I'll do it. And she also had a take, but it was also that's when it felt like it was getting taken away from them if they weren't actually going to do it themselves.
Well, it helps that it was known. It's not her saying something out loud that is new to people. Yeah. It frees her to comment on it, I guess.
Yeah, the whole movie to me, to kind of sum up my feelings about it, because the aesthetic was the thing that I found so striking about it from the get-go, from that first trailer, but then actually watching the movie. The aesthetic was the thing I always wanted to talk about because I think it's so radical. But all the ways in which the movie is a middle finger to Warner Brothers. So okay, great. fine, I'll go back and do the thing I didn't want to do, which was make a sequel to the trilogy. Fine. But it's not going to look the way that the product that you used to sell is going to look. It's going to have this radical departure of a look, and that's going to be alienating to some audiences, and you can deal with it. It's not going to tonally feel the same way. We're going to have more comedy. We're going to have more goofiness. The action is not going to be our main point of emphasis. You know, like, there's action and the action is good, but the scenes that really spark are the, like, the two-hander scenes where it's just two adults talking about their feelings or about how they feel controlled or broken or twisted in some kind of way.
Yeah, we already talked about how excited we were by those scenes, particularly the coffee shop scenes.
And then the finale of the movie, like, is, you know, you're talking about aesthetic, like, the analyst, that despicable little twerp that he is, he's like, fine, you guys win. You took over. You're in charge of my new Matrix. Go out. Paint the sky with rainbows if you want, which is an explicit callback to something that people hated at the end of Revolutions, where, you think that the whole stakes of the thing are going to be about ending the war and destroying the machines. And really, it's just this uneasy truce that Neo has waged. The truce is litigated by two machines, by the architect and by
the Oracle.
And then there's a rainbow in the sky, and he's saying, like, well, fine, paint with rainbows, but the sheeple, the audience, they're going to reject this rank sentimentality. And Lana's like, no, fuck you. And by the way, thank you, analyst/studio executive, for giving us another chance to come back and doing it, and to, like, come in and just canonically upend anything, and to throw out what came before, and to reject it all, and to take $200 million of Warner Brothers' money and light it on fire and like, fuck you, and walk out the door. It's such an audacious bit of, like, pop culture, complete obliteration, essentially.
It's so exciting to watch.
Yeah, I got that 4K. It finally came in. I watched it the other day. Man, that was time number five. I think I may be ready to put the movie to bed for a little while, and I'll come back to it fresh in a couple years. But, God, it's just so fucking watchable. It gets me every time. I get so sucked in.
And the things that it has to say about Warner Brothers, the things that it has to say about the fans.
And our culture and our aesthetic.
And our culture, yeah. It's a very exciting thing. And I love how it doesn't just show up. It does show up in the text, you know, as you said, the sheeple, as the analyst says. But it also, as you've, I think, very, very well demonstrated, it shows up in the aesthetic of the movie.
Well, I'm glad that I demonstrated that well. I think it's compelling when big studio product like this, that the form is as important to the themes and the thematic takeaways that the audience gets as, like you're saying, the text, like the events that happen and the words that are spoken. I just recently had the misfortune of watching everyone's favorite movie of 2021, Spider-Man No Way Home. And I just, like, it's aesthetically, it's just like vomit on screen, just like digital pixelated bullshit the entire time. But, like, and the aesthetic of,
don't hold back, Scott. Tell us what you really think.
It's so bad, Jamie. But the aesthetic of it is just, like, it contributes nothing other than, like, this is the familiar, ugly, unappealing Marvel house style, but somehow uglier and more unappealing than ever before. Like, I'm so glad, as I've said many times before, when a big, like, franchise pop culture entry like this is actually a movie and when it has something to say. And I love that this one communicates so much to us just in the form of it and not just in its literary qualities. So, Jamie, I've spoken plenty about this movie. You've spoken definitely plenty about Pinot Grigio. You've wrapped up your miniseries. I feel like we've come to a natural conclusion on the Matrix side. But the last important thing that we should discuss is, do we think we've learned anything by comparing these two things so long for so many hours the last several weeks? Like, do we, first of all, on the baseline pairing level, do you think that Pinot Grigio pairs with The Matrix Resurrections?
I think the narrative that I drew through these wines pairs with The Matrix Resurrections. Do I think broadly that picking up a Pinot Grigio off the shelf and drinking it with The Matrix Resurrections is a good pair? You know, it's going to kind of depend on that bottle of wine. I think that if I were going to choose one of these six wines to sit down and watch The Matrix with, or The Matrix Resurrections with, it would be the Fossil and Fawn, this final wine.
Really? Why this one?
Because it's the one out of the six that gets me excited about what's next. Matrix Resurrections gets me excited about what's next. Not that there's another Matrix movie, but that maybe there will be another movie made by these people, or maybe that these ideas will be picked up by the zeitgeist in some way. It's the lift that I feel like in my body about the possibilities of the future that I get both from this movie and from that wine.
There's also a nice aesthetic parallel in that. Just like how with this wine, I look at the label and it says Pinot Gris, and then I look at the contents and it's a red wine. And that is very surprising. And, you know, even for me, from my novice standpoint, thank you for ending with this one, Jamie, because I would have been totally bewildered if we started with this one. But yeah, like just like I look at this and the label says one thing and the content says something else, like the label says the Matrix, but the aesthetic inside is not what I know of as the Matrix. It's aggressive.
That is exactly true. Yeah. So did we come to a successful pairing? I think so. I did, in fact, watch this movie with a bottle of this wine, and I had a great time. And I think that there is good parallel. I hadn't thought of the difference between the label and the contents, and I love that also. But it may be more touch and go if you just like pick a bottle of Pinot Gris or Grigio up off the shelf, like from any producer or wherever. Like, will it pair with this movie? I don't know. Does Domaine Chauffite pair with this movie? I don't really know. I kind of don't think so. It's a good wine. This is a good movie, and I like watching good wines and watching good movies and drinking good wines. But yeah, my choice is Fossil and Fawn, 100%.
And there's also the nattiness. You know, the movie's all filmed on location in the real world with real sunlight. This is natty grape juice. It's less processed. There's more shit and chunkus in there. It's there's parallels. Yeah. There's good parallels. I like this as the final pairing bottle for the movie. I concur.
Me too.
And I feel like maybe I learned something over the course of these six episodes.
100% I learned something over the course of these six episodes.
I'm probably like 40% I learned something. But ask me later and maybe I'll have an answer for you.
There will be a pop quiz in our next recording.
All right. Well, so the miniseries is done. We're putting it to bed. We're definitely going to talk about Matrix Resurrections again on the show. It just won't get a whole episode and definitely not a whole miniseries again. And Pinot Grigio will, of course, come up, but we are putting these topics to bed for now. Before we dive into our next miniseries, next week, come on back and we're going to do a little palate cleanser, something not our regular programming. And we're going to talk about The Batman.
The Batman. Le Batman.
2022's The Batman. In a couple of days, it should be coming to HBO Max after its contractually mandated 45-day exclusive theatrical window, and it'll come to the streaming. I highly recommend seeing it theatrically if you can, and if you feel that you can do that safely where you live. But also, I'm looking forward to watching it again at home and kind of diving into it. And spoilers, Jamie and I have very divergent takes on this movie, and we thought it might be fun to like talk about something big and recent and actually popular that we don't agree about, so it's not just a circle jerk, as previously described.
That is correct. And I have not yet chosen at the time of this recording, I have not yet chosen a wine to pair with The Batman, although we'll certainly announce that on the socials, and I'm excited to dive into it, because Scott and I have already had a pretty decent discussion about The Batman, and I'd like to expand upon it.
So come back in 1 week for me and Jamie and a bottle of wine and Jabatman, and then come back in 2 weeks to find out where we're starting our next miniseries.
A brand new miniseries.
A new six-parter, not about Pinot Grigio, probably.
No promises that there won't be any Pinot Grigio, but we'll leave that to be discovered. Thank you, everyone, for joining us today. It is always a pleasure. Please follow us on the socials at Bigger Bottle Pod. If you have any comments, concerns, or questions, feel free to email us at biggerbottlepod@gmail.com. Tell your friends about the show, please, and make sure you rate, review, and follow the show wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode was produced and edited by Scott Hudson. That's me! Our social media presence is thanks to Jamie Harrison Rubin. That is him virtually right across from me. And also special thanks to Ross Kennard, who created our new art that you're all hopefully enjoying in thumbnail form on your podcatcher of choice.
Remember, everyone, drink more wine and watch more movies. It's good for you. We promise.
Oh, shit. Wait, there was one more thing that I had to say about Matrix Resurrections.
One more thing?
No, I'm kidding. That was it. We'll just end it right there.
I didn't think it was one more thing. I detected a bit. My was, bit detector was, like, was going off.
Maybe it was 100 more things. All right, I'm going to hit stop.
Okie dokie.